In late 1970, just north of Boston, Massachusetts, a young woman named Joanne had an affair with a young man named Bob. The story is that they had known each other since elementary school and had dated on and off during high school. At the time of their affair, they were both married to other people and had children with their respective spouses. Bob owned and worked at a gas station down the street from the home Joanne was living in. When she realized she was pregnant, Joanne told her husband, Lee, about the affair. Lee knew the child wasn't his, but Joanne refused to tell him who the father was, thinking that he would not be able to love this child as he did their other two children. Lee asked Joanne to consider giving it up for adoption. Knowing that her marriage was rocky and being unsure of their financial situation, Joanne agreed. Earlier that same year, a young couple several towns over were coming to terms with their infertility while acutely aware of their desire to have children. They began inquiring about adoption. They had been married for just under 6 years, each held stable jobs, and were church-going folk. Though in the eyes of the adoption agency, they were cheating a little on the church issue. The husband, Russ, was a Roman Catholic, but the mother, Carol, was a strange religion called Universalism. Using her experience of being a fourth-generation Universalist and having worked at the denomination's headquarters, Carol was able to assure the adoption agency that it was indeed a real religion. Carol and Russ were cleared to be parents a year and a half after their initial contact with the adoption agency. They were to adopt Joanne and Bob's baby, now named Robin. They were excited the first time they visited the new baby at a foster home, and Russ tells a beautiful story of holding the baby on his lap that day and feeling like a parent. After the adoption was finalized, Joanne and her family moved west. They were about halfway across this country when they ran out of money and needed to settle down for a few years. During these years, Joanne and Lee separated and eventually divorced. Lee took their younger child, Art, with him to Florida, and Joanne and the oldest child, Mary, moved on to California. Bob and his family, still all unaware that he had even fathered the baby Robin, remained where they were and continued their life as planned. Carol, Russ, and the newly adopted child began their life as a new family. This is the beginning of the story of my family. We don't all know each other, and we may never. Some we've met. I am the baby Robin. I am the adopted child. I am the common bond between us all, and I am the stranger. Sylvia Nolia Ramos writes in her poem, "See one face. When I look into the mirror, I see two faces. When I look at my life, I lead two lives, like happy and sad, like hand and glove, like bitter tears and sweet laughter. I have mastered my two lives." It is in the process of mastering my two lives that I became acutely aware of the impact my Unitarian Universalist upbringing has had on me. I had always been aware of the many faces, the many lives that I am living. At 10 months old, I was given a new name and a new identity, my first new life. I'm not sure why my birth mother named me Robin, and I may never know. But I do know that my parents named me Barbara because my mother had always wanted the name for herself. The meaning used in our family is stranger in a foreign land. As an adoptee, I cannot think of a name with a more appropriate meaning. And while I have shortened the original name to Barb, I still consider it a precious gift from my parents. My mother is a director of religious education emerita to the First Parish in Framingham, Massachusetts, where she served as DRE for over 15 years. Prior to serving in that congregation, she served in a neighboring town, and before that, she worked at what we now know of as the UUA, the UU Association of Congregations. My father was a Catholic altar boy who converted to Unitarian Universalism shortly after Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. He has been a stalwart member of the Framingham UU congregation ever since. Over the years, he has served at least one term on just about every committee. But what I love most about his church work is that he is that stealth member, and I bet you have some of them here, that stealth member who sneaks into the sanctuary weekly to tidy up, to straighten the chairs, to polish the brass, and reset the candles. So as you might imagine, attending church was not an optional activity in my family. I jokingly tell people that dinner conversations in our family revolved around church business more than how our days went. And even to present day, the church is often what binds us together. Almost 20 years ago, I discovered that my folks had changed their home phone number, that old-fashioned landline, the same one they'd had since moving into their home 40-odd years ago. Mind you, they did not tell me that they changed their number. Yep, I read it in the church newsletter. My home congregation holds an annual talent auction where members donate their skills to be bid on. It's a wonderful event for all whom attend, and it helps raise money for the church. One of the talents offered many years ago was that of a genealogy search. As is perhaps par for my family, my father and I ended up bidding against one another. Thankfully, I won, and as a result, I was able to further my search for my biological family. On Easter Sunday of 1997, I was handed a piece of paper with three names and phone numbers on it. The fellow who had done the genealogy research was certain that one of the names had to be the now ex-husband of my biological mother. It took me a day to work up the nerve to make those calls. And the Monday after Easter, I talked to my biological mother's ex-husband, Lee, my half-sister, Mary, my half-brother, Art, and my biological mother, Joanne. It was an incredible experience. My half-brother Art and I discovered that we have the same hobbies and like the same television shows. Lee shared his regrets at ever suggesting putting me up for adoption. He had been looking for me for several years. My half-sister Mary was pregnant with her first child and had hoped that we would find each other before she gave birth. And we all admitted to looking forward to a day when we could meet in person, with a little anxiety. Later that spring, I wrote to everyone to share with them that I was a transgender guy. I did my best to explain what this means to me and how our faith has supported and accepted both me and my gender. My birth mother, Joanne, was relieved to hear that I had a good family and was a churchgoer. But in further discussing our religious values, she pontifically disregarded our faith tradition and assured me that she would pray for my soul. Joanne's reaction was less than ideal. She demanded that I recant my queerness and refused to share any information about my birth father until I did. She died several years ago, continuing to refuse to be in relationship up until the moment of her death, taking any and all information about my biological father with her to the grave. My half-brother Art's wife and I had begun emailing shortly after I came out to everyone. We met a year later, and our connection helped Art accept me. Art and I meet every 5 or so years, and we have built a stronger and stronger relationship. The three of us cherish our ever-growing relationships and connections, and just over 2 years ago celebrated the birth of my grandniece. Not that I feel like I'm old enough to have a grandniece. I met Joanne's ex-husband, Lee, at the same time I met Art's wife. Up until that time, Lee and I had had a wonderful postal correspondence, with one exception. I had not come out to him. I had struggled every day with the lack of honesty that caused in our relationship. It was a chink in my integrity that made me very aware of two of the lives that I have had to live. Meeting face to face forced the issue of my identity, and he immediately discontinued our correspondence. When my half-sister Mary and I met for the first time, it was perhaps the hardest of the meetings. Mary seemed more interested in comparing our lives in proving that I got the better deal than she was interested in getting to know me. I had often wondered what my life would have been like if I had not been given up for adoption. Meeting parts of my biological family gave me an answer and a profound understanding of the impact growing up Unitarian Universalist has had on me. I wonder if I would have so successfully survived my teen years. Back then, I wondered if I would ever be understood and worried that I would never be able to be myself and be loved. Had I not had our Unitarian Universalist principles and the support of my congregation to fall back on, perhaps I would have given up during the difficult times. But I believe I'm one of the luckiest ones. Our faith tradition and institutions sustain me in the hours when my reason and the world around me tell me that my life is without meaning. My religious community gives me love and encouragement when I believe that I cannot continue. Without a doubt, I feel welcome at the congregation in which I grew up. But I don't always know if I will get that same welcoming reception in every Unitarian Universalist congregation I visit. As a lifelong Unitarian Universalist, I know that my inherent worth and dignity should be affirmed by my fellow UUs. And yet, I still wonder if it will happen. Not all people who enter our congregations and are different from the existing dominant cultures, who are leading more than one life, for whatever reason, feel this welcome. James Luther Adams wrote, "I call that church free, which in covenant with the divine community-forming power brings the individual into a caring and trusting fellowship that protects and nourishes the individual's integrity and spiritual freedom. I call that church free, which liberates from bondage to the principalities and power of the world, whether churchly or secular, and which promotes the continuing reformation of its own and other institutions." We call our churches free, spiritual places where people are welcome to bring their whole, integrated selves to share and grow. Our aspirations to create such free churches are honorable, but we need to follow up with good, solid action. We need to reform our institutions in order to liberate us from the bondage that says, "You are not welcome to talk about your whole life here." It is our responsibility to make sure that all people who enter our congregations will feel welcome to share their life stories with us. Not just the parts we are comfortable with, but the whole story. I think of all the people in the world who are expected to check part of their life at the door in order to be accepted and affirmed, who are expected to assimilate rather than flourish just as they are. I wonder what happens to their integrity and to the integrity of the community in which they are a part. I think of the many people who choose not to participate in our wonderful religious communities because they are worried about the reception they will get. I mourn for those who have experienced a reception similar to Jim from our story this morning, who have turned away and won't or can't come back. And I wonder about what our religious communities are missing out on because we let our prejudices and privileges and comfort go unchallenged. Sylvia Nolia Ramos wrote, "I have mastered my two lives. I invite you to help your congregation master its two lives. Take note of the people in this religious community. Notice who is not among you and question why. Pay attention to the explicit and implicit messages you are giving to each other and your visitors. Challenge yourselves to let go of some of the traditions and cultural assumptions that you hold in order to make space for the beloved community that can be. And remember that it is in embracing all of each other's lives that we can learn to be whole people, one with another. May it be so. And may we be the ones to make it so. Amen."